In the coming week, Ethiopia declares a state of emergency as its civil war intensifies. China holds a crucial meeting of the Communist Party's Central Committee, and Sudan inches toward a new power-sharing deal to reverse last week's coup. It's November 4th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Michelle Gavin, sitting in for Jim Lindsay.
Michelle is the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at CFR and a first-time guest co-host on The World Next Week. Michelle, it's great to have you on the show.
I'm really happy to be here. Thanks, Bob.
Well, let's start right off with a place you are well familiar with, Ethiopia. You've been tracking closely the conflict, certainly since it broke out about a year ago in northern Tigray. Earlier this week, Ethiopian officials declared a state of emergency and called on citizens to prepare to defend the capital, Addis Ababa, as rebel forces from the northern region of Tigray continue to capture cities across the country. This is a fast-moving story, Michelle, but could you bring us up to speed on what's happening in Ethiopia at the moment?
Well, I can try, and the short answer is nothing good. You're absolutely right. The Tigrayan forces have had some significant military successes, and as have, it appears, their allies for now in the Oromo Liberation Army. So you have these two armed groups in a sort of marriage of convenience coming closer to the capital, and the sort of palpable sense of alarm coming from government and from elites in Addis Ababa, I think, has really shaken up the international community. As you rightly stated, this conflict's been underway for almost exactly a year now. But what we're seeing today are statements, you know, coming from IGAD, the regional grouping there in the Horn of Africa, from the AU, from the rest of the international community, urgently calling on all parties to de-escalate, calling for a ceasefire, calling for moving this conflict into a political lane, because no one sees a sustainable military solution.
Michelle, you mentioned the so far temporary alliance. Is it correct to say these are allied along basically ethnic grounds? These are ethnic groups that have found common cause against the government, which constitutes mainly another ethnic group.
Well, these groups actually, the OLA and the TPLF, are certainly not natural allies. There's some fairly ugly history there. But I think it's more about a sense of feeling threatened by the center, by Prime Minister Abiy and his Prosperity Party's project, which these groups read as one that is about consolidating authority in the center, removing some of the rights of different kind of constituent elements of the Ethiopian state. But it is, you know, their kind of political agendas are not necessarily the same.
We have seen pretty awful reports about the humanitarian situation and abuses, certainly from Tigray, and reports that seem to cast blame across a wide net. So it's all forces involved in the conflict seem to be committing their own sense of abuses and even atrocities. I would assume that's part of what's driving the urgency of this situation in terms of the international community's approach, Michelle?
Absolutely. You have a sort of multiple crises at the same time. You have the urgent humanitarian crisis in Tigray, which has really been under a state of siege. Humanitarian materiel, including urgently needed food, has been unable to enter the area. There are over 400,000 people living in famine conditions right now, millions more at risk. The indicators that are coming out from the UN and others are really quite dire about the situation. And so the Tigrayan forces claim that, you know, their advance closer to the capital is necessary because the Tigrayan people are living in a state that makes survival very, very challenging. And the federal government has been unwilling for months to make substantial and lasting changes to this humanitarian access question. But then there's the kind of broader question of the overall Ethiopian state, if it can remain united, how you get back on a road to stability at this point, and some sort of shared idea about where legitimacy springs from. And there's also a set of human rights violations going on, you know, countrywide. There are numerous kind of political contestations in Ethiopia. It's not just about Tigray, or it's certainly not just about the OLA. MPLA, but also over the course of this conflict, as rhetoric has ramped up, there's been targeting of Ethiopian citizens of Tigrayan descent outside of Tigray. And we're getting reports now of mass arrests, the rounding up of people in Addis and elsewhere that are really very disturbing. You know, the Biden administration has used the term ethnic cleansing before. And as sort of the tensions come to a head with this conflict, I think there's a lot of concern about what's going to happen to civilians, not just in Tigray, but throughout the country.
Michelle, in your blogging on this, you've written somewhat ominously about like how far this could play out. And we're already seeing some very severe reprisals. And as you're saying, the extension of the reprisals. Is there leverage that the outside world has, regional actors, the United States, to try to bring an end to this? Certainly, initially, I guess, against the government in Addis Ababa, but also on the rebel side?
Well, there is some leverage. It's limited. It's not been terribly effective thus far. But yes, the U.S. is the largest donor of assistance to Ethiopia, even now, after some of that assistance has been frozen due to the concerns that we've just discussed. You also had this week the announcement that in the absence of a change of course, Ethiopia will not be eligible for AGOA benefits. That's the African Growth and Opportunity Act that provides duty-free access to U.S. markets for some African goods. AGOA benefits are incredibly important, actually, to Ethiopia's manufacturing sector, a big part of sort of the plan to bring more Ethiopian people out of poverty. So between Ethiopia's debt situation, this issue of AGOA, it would be very difficult for anyone in the federal government to think that they could continue on the current course without sort of incurring very dramatic damage to the Ethiopian economy.
Do you think the Ethiopian government is in a position or in a mindset that it will be able to sort of take a step back to try to calm the situation, you know, potentially create some concessions that will allow the situation to calm and ultimately get back to this position that you mentioned of creating a situation in which the country has a sense of stakeholders who feel like their rights are being respected and reflected?
I hope so, but it's a really hard path from here to there. You know, the delegitimization of other parties where, you know, from the federal government's perspective, the TPLF is a terrorist organization, makes it very hard to agree to any kind of talks. I also have very real concerns about the degree to which Prime Minister Abiy and his allies are actually going to be able to retain control over all of the forces they have mobilized, which include sort of some essentially ethnic militia elements in this struggle. It's not clear to me that if they tried to turn this off, they could in its totality.
So we could be watching the situation get a great deal worse before it gets any better.
I fear that that is the case. But Bob, can we turn our attention to the sixth plenary session of the 19th Chinese Communist Party Central Committee, which is set to take place between November 8th and November 11th? This session coincides with the CCP's 100-year anniversary, and President Xi is anticipated to introduce the third historical resolution in the CCP's history. Can you tell us some more about the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party itself and what we should anticipate from this high-level meeting?
Sure, Michelle. I mean, as you mentioned, it's a 100-year anniversary of the CCP. All sorts of symbolism, all sorts of importance for the country in reflecting on this century in power, on where the country is right now, on where it sees itself and where it sees itself going forward. I think an important place to start is with President Xi. It's been widely noted by the top China experts that he now possesses more power than any certainly communist leader since Chairman Mao, and that this plenary will, in all likelihood, set in motion further steps to entrench his power and help him to serve beyond his next term, which I believe ends in 2023. And with that, sort of embody where he sees the country going. All sorts of things are in motion right now. Whether you start with the COVID pandemic, which the country is emerging from, although it's still dealing with a few resurgent outbreaks here and there, continues to be very strong in rebuffing attempts by World Health Organization, other leading nations in the world to open up some sort of investigation into the origins of COVID, which is widely suspected to have originated in or near Wuhan, but then setting in motion how the country sees itself and where it sees its role in the world, which is increasingly assertive, increasingly aggressive in how it sees its role in its quote-unquote near abroad. And, you know, let's start first and foremost on Taiwan. There is likely to be a decision, according to many experts, coming out of this sixth plenum on defining some sort of retaking of Taiwan as a core objective of mainland China. And so certainly the country has been moving in that direction. direction with its all sorts of military maneuvers, overflights, sort of unprecedented degree of threatening behavior by Chinese, you know, military craft, airplanes, and so forth. And so potentially some articulation of a goal of retaking of Taiwan. Xi has said fairly recently that he stresses the country is looking for a peaceful reunification with Taiwan. But there are many who see also an absence of any sort of rejection of a military course as also striking. So we're going to have to keep an eye on that. There's also the economic front, you know, reasserting what the role of the Belt and Road Initiative is in terms of how China sees its role in expanding its influence in the world and creating the wherewithal for countries in the region across the world to be part of a feedback loop, a market loop, part of the country's growing economy. And then you have issues of that deal with a little bit more of culture, but also of how the country defines itself as so-called socialism with Chinese characteristics. So understanding where China, how it intends to interpret socialism and the way that sits alongside its sort of booming trade and its desire to expand its trade and development influence. There's been a lot noted about the term common prosperity, which has been a new attempt from the Chinese leadership to try to rein in some of the sort of animal forces of capitalism that have grown. Certainly, there's a large number of Chinese millionaires and billionaires, and sort of reining in their influence, certainly, and also the influence of things like e-commerce platforms and even video games. The Chinese government, through the Chinese Communist Party, is taking a very assertive role domestically. It has a sense of an expanding role internationally. So that's why there's a great deal of buzz about this plenum, which, you know, as you were describing it, it sounds like ho-hum, this is another political conference. Well, in fact, it's a crucial rising country. And where does it see itself in the world going forward?
And how much is Xi constrained by the party at this point? Is the CCP in the driver's seat, or is it really one individual leader's vision at this point?
That's a great question. It seems increasingly like it is Xi's vision that is becoming enshrined in statements and documents that come out of party gatherings. Xi thought and Xi's vision on all sorts of fronts, whether it's social conservatism, whether it's the way the country cracks down on Uyghurs in Xinjiang, or whether how it sees its role in the South China Sea and sort of opening up lanes for Chinese commerce, but also space for Chinese military patrols and things like that. Xi seems to be extending his influence across all these areas. And the party, while still a check, because this is the party elite and these are the powers that be in the country, I think you're going to see, or it's going to be very closely watched, to the extent to which there is any serious check on Xi. And so it's this meeting and its follow-up meetings in the years ahead that we're going to see whether Xi's role in the country just gets more baked in and what that means for succession. You know, he's getting on in years. He's not elderly by any means, but it's still for the sake of stability, for the sake of what's at stake with China's direction. I think it would be important to see some sort of succession plan, and that's going to be something that's going to be looked for.
You know, you mentioned both the foreign policy and economic issues that are sort of looming large in China right now, but what about the environmental issues, which I know have mobilized people in Chinese society, but it was notable that Xi didn't go to Glasgow. And how important are these issues? How urgent are they?
That's a really good question as well, Michelle. I think it was notable that Xi did not go to Glasgow, although he has not traveled since the pandemic's outbreak. I think it's going to be worth watching how the Chinese delegation handles its negotiations, how serious it is committed to what takes place over the remaining days of the Glasgow conference. As has been noted before that conference, China did make an announcement that it was no longer going to be investing in coal development and coal exploitation abroad, although it still has a very robust use of coal domestically. It has huge use of it and is going to be using it for multiple decades to come. It's also a leading country in renewables, though. And so I don't know whether the plenum will set a direction there necessarily, but that is going to be very interesting to see. China is absolutely crucial. It had made, before the Paris conference 6 years ago, it had made common cause with the U.S. on reaching goals of cutting emissions sharply. It has made some wary steps towards talking about these same goals with the U.S. climate envoy John Kerry, but U.S.-China relationship is in a much worse situation than it was 6 years ago. So we'll have to see whether or not the countries can compartmentalize their relationship as it concerns climate issues, while there's all these other areas. I mentioned Taiwan, I mentioned the Uyghurs, and there's also ongoing crackdown in Hong Kong and ongoing tariffs against some Chinese exports that are things that are hugely complicating the U.S.-China relationship. But there is, I think, some genuine concern about the carbon emissions that China should be looked for some sense of added gestures coming out of Glasgow, because it is something that is a common destiny. And the Chinese have been concerned about their own air quality, which has been been just dreadful. They have an Olympics coming up, by the way, in Beijing that I think is going to be closely watched for the air quality, again, just as it was back in 2008. I would actually ask one quick question to you, Michelle, as our Africa expert, the extent to which you've seen Chinese expansion of its influence, if not its visibility in Africa.
There is no question that China is one of the most influential and highly visible actors on the scene across the African continent. And, you know, polling shows that African people, it's not just government elites, recognize China to be, alongside the U.S., one of the two sort of most important and influential external actors. There's some worry about indebtedness, but also a lot of enthusiasm for the Chinese development model. And certainly leaders in Africa with more authoritarian tendencies are very eager to invoke the idea of an authoritarian development model as one that Africa should follow.
Because it doesn't come with maybe some of the checks on their behavior as China, say, goes in to invest in infrastructure. It's not going to necessarily hold these countries' feet to the fire if they have sort of human rights abuses or such.
Certainly, it's less complicated to work with the Chinese sometimes, although, you know, there are plenty of examples of African governments and societies that are rather unhappy with the results of certain Chinese investments. So it's a really mixed bag. And I think that for many African leaders, right, they invoke China when it's convenient to justify an authoritarian approach, when it's convenient to explain away why they didn't choose other options. But, you know, Africa is interested in its own agenda, and they will lean on the Chinese, on the U.S., on any external actor that can help to advance it.
All right. So we'll keep an eye on the plenum for all sorts of signals, international and domestic. But I wanted to stay with Africa, actually, Michelle, and come back to another country facing a potentially pivotal moment, which is Sudan. So this week, Sudan's army and politicians move closer to what looks like a power sharing deal in the midst of intensifying international pressure. You have Saudi Arabia, the UAE, the United Kingdom, and the United States urging the restoration of the civilian government and negotiations between the coup leader, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, former rebel groups, and the ousted prime minister, Abdallah Hamdok. So, Michelle, could you tell us a bit about where the situation is in Sudan right now?
Absolutely. You're right. The international community broadly has been engaged in a number of mediation efforts. Some observers worry that there may be too many cooks in the mediation kitchen here, but essentially trying to reverse this coup that was perpetrated on October 25th. So since former President Omar al-Bashir and the NCP were ousted in Sudan, you've had the country governed by a transitional arrangement. It's been a kind of uneasy partnership between a set of civilian politicians and military actors. And the coup was an instance of the military side of that equation getting increasingly uncomfortable with the idea of turning some power and leadership over to the civilians and taking matters into its own hands. The international community has almost entirely rejected the coup, although there are noticeable outliers, particularly Egypt, which has been quite supportive of the military officials. But interestingly, the Sudanese people have made themselves really kind of indispensable actors in this drama, pouring out onto the streets in support of civilian-led government and a continued transition to democracy, in some cases at the cost of their lives. And they have persisted in their demonstrations, in national strikes. And I think one of the really difficult things for mediators right now is that much of the discussion among diplomats is about how to kind of get back to the partnership that Sudan was experiencing before October 25th. But the leadership of these mass demonstrations, which was very significant too in getting rid of the old regime, is very uncomfortable with this idea. You know, trust is going to be in very short supply. And the notion that you would go back to a partnership with a group of actors who proved willing to take up arms to enforce their will, I don't think is going to sit very well with the street. So the real balancing act now is how to acknowledge the fact that the military is not simply going to go away. They do have a monopoly on the use of force here, but the vast majority of the Sudanese people do not want to see them retain the same levers of power that they had a few weeks ago.
This is fascinating to hear about this role of the so-called Sudanese street, because up until recently, Sudan, it was all about the power brokers, the military, the certain vested interests that held sway. And you do that. It is striking to see these demonstrations, to see reports coming out of pockets of Sudan where people are standing up. Is there any sort of sense that there's a representative of the so-called Sudanese street that could step in and play play a role if these talks end up foundering, Michelle?
Well, Prime Minister Hamdok has a great deal of support from the demonstrators, the pro-democracy activists. So it's not as if it's just kind of an amorphous group of people with no connection to any of these political elites. But certainly the notion of maintaining cohesion among the demonstrators is going to be really, really difficult for a set of reasons. One, because it's a massive tent, right? The group of Sudanese people who rejected the old regime and who reject military rule don't necessarily agree entirely on how they want the country to be governed. Now, that ultimately should be manageable, right? That's true of virtually every country, right? There's a set of different ideas about policy and priorities, and that gets managed through a rule-governed political system. But in the absence of that, it becomes very easy to sow division, to drive wedges intended to kind of get this very powerful manifestation of Sudanese will in disarray. And this is something that, you know, parts of the Sudanese state have been good at for a very, very long time. So as we come to this difficult question about what should the future role of the military be, I am concerned that you'll have different voices from this vast pro-democracy civic movement with different positions, and that this could be, you know, used as an excuse for why you just need a strong man back in charge.
I mentioned these four leading actors trying to exert pressure. At the end of the day, how much influence can they have? The US, UK, the Saudis, and the UAE?
A tremendous amount of influence. So, you know, one reason that Sudan is even involved in a transition is because this sort of economics of its isolation just became untenable. And there's been a lot of work over this transitional period to address the crushing debt burden in Sudan. The U.S. moved them off the list of state sponsors of terrorism, which creates some new economic opportunity. And you can sort of cut all of that off. And it's very difficult to see how sustainably you could govern Sudan. So there's a great deal of international leverage economically. And then, you know, actors like the UAE have a very important role to play in the Sudanese economy, and particularly in some of the economic opportunities that have been available to the military and to security elites. So there's a great deal of international leverage and a lot of unity. But again, you do have actors like Egypt and Russia, which is interested in pursuing access to a naval base in Port Sudan, who may have very different agendas.
I should know, we've been talking about two countries on this podcast that Ethiopia and Sudan that have not been having the greatest relations of recent. Any sense that the way these, they're both of their respective crises turn out could exacerbate their own relations and potentially, you know, create some interstate tensions as well?
Absolutely. There is, you know, kind of the inescapable interrelated nature of the many crises that are gripping the Horn of Africa right now. And, you know, the prospect of state collapse in Ethiopia means refugee flows into Sudan. You've already seen a significant number of refugees in the tens of thousands from Tigray that have crossed the border. There's a border dispute in Al-Fashaga, and then there's a huge and existential political issue before Sudan, Ethiopia, and Egypt around the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. So there are important issues that various actors can kind of jockey for position on during these times of turbulence and instability. There's the reality that real chaos in any of these states is going to immediately infect the rest of the region. And there's also the worry that all of this uncertainty and turmoil, in fact, plays into the hands of those who claim you just need a firm military hand to get everything under control.
All right. So we'll see in Sudan whether there's enough of a democratic resilience to help them see through this chapter.
Yeah. What they've displayed thus far, I think, has surprised the world and is really quite extraordinary. Well, I think it's time to pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. So this week, Bob, our audience selected COVID vaccines for 5 to 11-year-olds. Something I am personally deeply invested in as the parent of an 8-year-old. Why did our audience select this figure, Bob?
Well, Michelle, it's focused on this decision in the U.S., although there's international ramifications, but this came after the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention endorsed the Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine. So that's one of the two sort of new technology vaccines that's taken in two doses. That had already been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And so the country is now ramping up, as we speak, the infrastructure to be able to distribute doses for an estimated 29 million children that are in that age group. And it's estimated that immunizing children 5 to 11 in the U.S. could prevent about 600,000 new coronavirus cases between now and March 2022, Michelle. So significant, obviously, parents like yourself and parents all over the place, anybody, there is a connection to this and keenly interested in this. Obviously, vaccines of all sorts are something that parents have always regularly wanted to have their children have. This year, it runs smack into a cultural war about the propriety of governments forcing citizens to have or mandating workplaces to have vaccines. In this case, citizens to have vaccines and then citizens to have their children vaccinated when there's all sorts of wariness about these vaccines. You know, public service announcement. The vaccines work. They're incredibly effective at preventing severe COVID and certainly hospitalization and death. So I think it's a really important moment. There's been relatively few, if we look internationally, relatively few countries have opened up to this age group. You still have actually a lot of countries that are just opening up to young teens or to children as young as 12. So getting to the 5 to 11 year old group is a small group of countries that so far have allowed this. So the United States is joining countries like China, Chile, Argentina, I think Cuba as well, and not that many more. So I think you're going to be seeing European countries closely watching how this plays out in the U.S. as other vaccines are also considered for approval as well. And sort of watching warily in the event of any sort of, you know, reaction to the vaccine among youngsters. But I think a great deal of interest in the United States, particularly as we're in the run up to the Thanksgiving holidays. It already feels like a more open Thanksgiving than last year, certainly. But having children get vaccinated as families consider reuniting for the holidays is a huge deal. So a really big moment for the country, but also for the world.
Absolutely. And, you know, as someone who's spent most of my career working in Africa, where I've met many people who've gone to great lengths to get their children vaccinated against various infectious diseases, you know, walk for days, I can say that I'm thrilled that so many children in the United States are going to be able to be protected now. And it's, I think, a really exciting development that maybe can help bring the national conversation closer too to how we live when COVID becomes a less threatening endemic virus, which is a conversation we all need to have.
I wonder, Michelle, in as you observed various vaccine rollouts in Africa, have you encountered this kind of anti-vax sentiment among Africans and effective ways that have been used to deal with it?
Well, it's been something that I've encountered in specific settings where there has been a history, for example, of unethical medical trials. You know, there's a famous incident in Nigeria that comes to mind. So, you know, there have been specific communities who've had concerns for very specific and historically grounded reasons. One worrying trend that we see today is that a lot of the kind of misinformation and disinformation around COVID and COVID vaccines that have infected American society, this is globalized. And there is real vaccine hesitancy in some African societies as well.
Yeah. And what we've also seen globalized, obviously, is the use of social media for disinformation and misinformation. So it's the logistics of it, but it's also the messaging and getting beyond the so-called infodemic, I think, too.
Right. And really thinking about where moral authority and public trust is found in a given society so that people can get information from sources that they believe in and rely on. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. A general election takes place in Nicaragua. The EU ECOFIN Council meets in Brussels. And Veterans Day is marked in the United States.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it to help us get noticed and improve the show. By the way, the blog posts I mentioned that Michelle writes for the Africa in Transition blog are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. We're taking next week off for Veterans Day, but we'll be back with a new episode of The World Next Week in 2 weeks. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis and senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Thanks, Zoe. Special thanks to Maya Kin and Rafael Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Michelle Gavin signing off and saying thanks again for having me as a guest host.
This is Bob McMahon saying thanks very much, Michelle. It's great to have you on the show, and so long all, and stay healthy out there.